Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee for Monday, June 24th. Great to see such a crowded room, and thank you, members, for showing up on time. We have a lot of bills to get through and a couple of legislators in the room to talk about them. So I think we will start by opening a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2206A. So that's not what you're here for. Oh.
You're just going to be a hulking, looming presence in the back row, Madam Chair.
Well, since we already opened it, let's go ahead. Okay, so Lori, would you tell us about House Bill 2206?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2206 allows the governing body to request that governor declare county elections emergency. It directs the Secretary of State to provide election services in a county until earlier of determination by governor that emergency no longer exists or 2 years after the declaration of the emergency. It requires that the Secretary of State seek reimbursement from emergency board for funds and spending authority. It requires funds retained by Director of Veterans Affairs out of distribution to county without county veterans service officer to be spent to provide veteran services in that county in manner deemed appropriate by the director. It authorizes the county to request a declaration by the governor of an emergency in county that is providing less than minimally adequate property tax assessment and collection services. It specifies reimbursement for costs for collection services will come from A, transfer of assessment and taxation county account that would have been distributed by county function funding assistance account, or CAFA. Transfer of assessment, B, transfer of assessment and taxation county account all shared funds. C, seeking reimbursement from emergency board. It requires the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to enter into an agreement to combine resources for the purpose of administration and enforcement of a municipal building inspection program if municipality is not carrying out program or at request of the public body. No later than February 28, 2017, Secretary of State, Director of Veterans Affairs, Director of Department of Revenue, and Director of Department of Consumer Business and Services shall report to the Senate and House Committee on Rules. Takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die. The Dash 8-5 amendment attached by hard copy to your SMS removes the provisions that prescribe certain actions by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. There's a no revenue impact attached, and we're waiting for the fiscal. On the A-5, it moved in the version, A version moved off the House floor with 54 ayes, 5 nays, and 1 excused.
Okay, thank you, Lori. We have 3 people signed up to testify on this bill, so I'll call them all together, John Phillips, Michael Burdick, and Chris Fick, if the 3 of you would like to come forward. And you're up here because we thought Senator Boquist wanted to testify, but I think he's eagerly awaiting hearing your brief testimony. So please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips. I'm representing the office of the COO today. We're here because 2206 is intended to provide a backstop safety net situation for a circumstance that we hope does not happen. And that is the situation that's developing in some of the southwestern Oregon counties related to the timber payments. We hope that the county is able to continue financing its election services, its veteran service officer, and its assessment and taxation system under the property tax. But in the event that they're unable to, this bill would provide some authority for the Elections Department, the Veterans Department, and the Department of Revenue to step in and provide some of the shore up some of the services there. It has a limited duration, so it also has cooperation of the county, the local government involved, and we worked through a number of amendments on the House side. We also have the Dash A-5, which I believe Chris will speak to, and we were very concerned about not making it so easy that a county would just turn over its services to the state. There are some provisions for some reimbursement, and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I think we'll hear from all of you and then take questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Burdick with the State Treasurer's Office. I'm here to communicate the Treasury's strong support of House Bill 2206 and summarize the concerns we have that the bill addresses. Our debt management director, Laura Lockwood McCall, is on furlough today, and so unfortunately she can't be here with you. But if you do have any technical questions, I'd be happy to take them to her and get you a response promptly. her interest was driven, has driven our interest in this concept, and it now comprises Section 4 of the bill. And our reason for being concerned is the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Program. The Treasury oversees school districts and community colleges who come to the state treasury and are authorized under statute to get state guarantees on their school bonds if they're general obligation bonds. The state doesn't come out of pocket for any of this guarantee, but we pledge that we'll pay the debt service if the school district can't, and then we would reimburse ourselves with the school's state aid. The program started many years ago, and since bond insurance became unavailable in the late 2000s, we are now the only game in town in terms of improving these credit issues. We currently have $3.2 billion in outstanding school bond guarantees, representing $4.7 million in ongoing debt service over the life of those bonds. And in any given year, we would guarantee about $325 million in new school bond issues. And our debt management director's concern relates to county tax collection assessment services and fiscally distressed counties. Basically, if those systems were to begin falling apart, the likelihood that the state would have to come out of pocket and pay the debt service would become greater. And then we, of course, would reimburse ourselves out of their state aid, which, of course, is greatly needed in that county. Of course, that's never happened, and we don't want it to happen, but it could happen, and we believe it's prudent to plan. So as Ms. Lockwood recall was in discussions about a year ago with the Department of Revenue, it became clear they were willing and able to take care of these assessment and taxation functions if the county was unable to do so, but they were not able to get their costs reimbursed. So that's what led to our Section 4 of this bill. In sum, we recommend passage of House Bill 2206 in order to ensure orderly payment of these obligations. And I'll just add that we've been in discussions with the governor's office and other stakeholders. We have seen the amendments that have been discussed. We have seen and approved the -A5 amendment.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, other members of the committee, Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities for the record. The League is requesting the -A5 amendments, and as was described by staff, this just deletes the provision regarding building codes. The reason we've requested this amendment is that this full body, the full Senate and the House, have passed a bill, Senate Bill 582, which deals in much greater depth and detail about building codes and their who would take over the various functions if a county or a city were unable to perform those. We have the agreement of all the parties on that bill and on this amendment striking this provision, so that's why we are asking of it, you to adopt those -A5 amendments.
Okay. Any questions for these folks? Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The SMS mentions the word emergency no less than 10 times in the first paragraph. There's one fiscal distress. There's one less than minimally adequate level of public safety services and one less than minimally adequate level of property tax assessment and collection services. And yet the bill goes into effect 91 days after its passage. Why is there no emergency clause in this bill dealing with emergencies?
Madam Chair and Senator Farrioli, I don't know the actual reason for not having an emergency clause. It does have a section, Section 4, that deals with taxation, and it is possible that LC opined that the taxation prohibition in Article 9, Section 1A suggests that it couldn't have an emergency clause if it related to taxation regulation.
Madam Chair, I just wondered because we slap emergency clauses on things like people use shin plasters in this process. And to see a bill that actually is aimed at dealing with emergencies of fiscal collapse, not to have an emergency clause, it's like, really? But if that's the answer because of the assessment and taxation issues, I'm happy not to see the emergency clause. It just seems ironic to me.
Madam Chair, if I could answer further. Senator Farrioli, it's also absolutely appropriate for the Department of Revenue and likely the Elections Department to be in close contact and communication with any county that's on the precipice of falling.
Having an emergency?
We would be down in that county. We would be assisting that county. We would be doing everything up until the point of taking more dramatic measures. So I think we're going to be acting before the effective date of this bill to bolster those services and to be there for them. But there are some areas we cannot go into until the effective date, which would be hopefully September, early September.
Okay. I don't see any other questions for you. Thank you very much for your testimony. So, members, we cannot move this yet because we're waiting for the fiscal impact statement, which hopefully will come while we're sitting here. So I will, I guess I can just recess this hearing. So I'll recess the work session on House Bill 2206, and I will open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2747A. And Lori, could you please tell us about this one?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2747A prohibits districts that admit non-resident students from considering race, religion, sex, sexual orientation, ethnicity, national origin, disability, and other factors when determining whether to give consent or establishing any terms of consent. It establishes that the district school board considering admission by giving consent may only require name, contact info, birthday, grade level, and information about student being expelled from a school. Prohibits the district school board from requesting from others when considering admission. One, information about race, religion, sex, and other factors. Two, academic records, including participation in a talented and gifted program or special education program. Or three, request or require student to participate in an interview or request other specified information. It allows the district to limit the number of students to whom it gives consent. Requires the district school board to use lottery selection if a number of students seeking admission exceeds limitation and allows for preference given to siblings in lottery. It permits the district school board to revise maximum number of students for whom consent will be given at other than annual date established by board if there are no pending applications. It allows the district school board to determine length of time for which consent admission is valid. It requires the district school board to provide written explanation to student if it decides not to give consent. It applies to the 2014-2015 school year. There's a dash A11 that came up this morning. And there's a hard copy, it's on OLIS as well. That clarifies that the district school board may establish minimum behavior and attendance standards. It clarifies that prospective student is not prohibited by provisions from touring the facilities of the district or requesting information from the district. It specifies that the student admitted to a long-term facility or skilled nursing facility is considered a resident of the district in which the facility is located for purposes of determining provision of educational services. Makes the long-term facility and skilled nursing facility provisions applicable to the 2013-2014 school year. It sunsets those provisions on June 30th, 2014. It adds an emergency clause to the measure, and it makes it effective July 1st, 2013.
Oh, sure.
And there's... I didn't do it for your benefit.
Kids are so anxious to get into school, we need an emergency clause.
There are two. There's the revenue impact statement and the fiscal impact statement connected. It's a minimal fiscal statement, minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued. And the revenue is also, hard copy is attached to revenue impact. Talking about the school formulas.
Great. Thank you, Lori. And I see that we have Representative Gelser in the room, and then Senator Devlin, my understanding is, did you wish to testify, or?
Did you wish to have the bill passed?
I can keep my testimony really short and then turn it over to Representative Gelser, if that's okay. Mm-hmm.
That would be great. And so I do want to, just before we take your testimony, mention that if people are listening to this hearing, we are going to be considering the version of the bill that's contained in the bill as amended by the dash A11s, which came out today. They did incorporate the dash A7 amendments that we had originally posted, as well as some further perfections, I guess, of this bill that have been worked on recently. So please go ahead, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I've had a fairly long history with this bill. I do have my concerns about the bill. However, the chair has made some changes to the bill Your dash 11s actually incorporate some additional changes the chair agreed to in the dash A3s, which actually addressed some of the issues that some of the schools within my district have and other schools have. Then actually came the amendments that were additional in dash 7s, which were to deal with the issue for the Portland School District, and I believe an issue with children that are basically in need of full-time care, residential care. And then the chair of the House Education Committee was willing to entertain the only additional item that came in the dash 11s was a provision at my request that nothing within the bill prohibited a student on their own volition, from requesting information about the school in which they plan to transfer to or requesting a tour of the school in which they transferred to. And the chair of the House Education Committee has indicated that she's supportive of that amendment. I actually do still remain concerned about the bill, but I'm very appreciative of the chair's efforts to make the bill better.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. We do what we can here.
Okay.
So thank you for your testimony, and we'll let you get back to your very busy duties elsewhere. And Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser, and I'm the state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath, and I'm also the chair of the House Education Committee. This bill comes to you from the House Education Committee. It's an education committee bill, and I wanted to bring apologies and regrets from Representative Sherry Springer, who's the vice chair of the committee. She was welcoming a new international student from Spain who's staying in her home and needed to leave this afternoon, but she asked for me to convey her ongoing support for this measure. The base bill, House Bill 2747, does a very simple thing. It extends the non-discrimination protections that we wrote into the open enrollment law into the interdistrict transfer law. We've had a lot of conversation about open enrollment, which is where a student can go to another district without the permission of the school district that they live in. Interdistrict transfer is the other way that you move. And in that case, both the district you want to enroll in and the district that you live in have to say, that's okay. So when we passed the open enrollment law, I was really on the fence about that bill and watched really carefully how that was implemented across the state. And one of the things that was really disappointing to me was to see school districts decide that they didn't want to participate on the basis that they would have to admit certain kinds of students. Low-income students, students from certain kinds of neighborhoods, students with disabilities, students that spoke English as a second language. And districts were so concerned about this that they were willing to talk about it very openly. They talked about these kids as salvage projects, that they would be bringing in kids that aren't moneymakers, and I don't think that that's what we're in the public education business for. It seemed that if a school district had openings and they wanted to accept other students into their public school system, that every public school student should have the same opportunities to choose a public school option as any other district. In talking with the Department of Education, considering these factors actually is not allowable. Our state statute prohibits discrimination on these personal characteristics. But we do have districts, most districts, ask for some of this information, especially about disability and primary language on their applications. So this bill just says you can't ask for information on an application that you're not, under the law, allowed to consider. I believe that the amendment that Senator Devlin spoke of is a very good one. It clarifies that, of course, we want students to tour schools and get information about them. We want people to make good choices before they make these choices. But the bill at its base is really about basic fairness. One other quick story. In the Senate Education Committee, we did have a parent come in and offer some testimony about how this impacted her family. She actually lives here in Salem, is a constituent of Senator Courtney's, but her husband is the principal of Corvallis High School in Corvallis, where I live. They have an 11th grade daughter in a Salem high school, and they have a 9th grade son this year, and they didn't want to move to Corvallis until after their junior graduated from high school. So they applied for an interdistrict transfer for their 9th grade son because his special education team, both in Salem and the special education team in Corvallis and the family and everyone that knew this child, agreed that what was best for him was to be served in the Corvallis school district. Even though his father was the principal of the school to which he would attend, the school district denied his interdistrict transfer on the basis that he had a disability and accepted other students from out of the district in the same grade, in the same same school in the same year. That's really not fair. Aaron should have had the same opportunities as anyone else to attend Corvallis High School, and this bill would fix that problem. The other amendment that is in here, I wanted to speak briefly to the Providence and Portland School District issue. Very recently, you probably read about this in the newspaper just a couple of weeks ago, Portland was re-looking at statutes that govern residents, and some questions arose about whether or not Portland really is legally responsible for providing education for all 58 students that reside at the Providence Child Center, which is a long-term care facility or a skilled nursing facility. Children go and they stay at the facility not for a couple of weeks or a couple of months, but I believe the average length of stay is 10 to 12 years. So for the past couple of decades, Portland has been serving these students. But uncertain about whether or not they had the legal authority and ability to do that, they informed the families last month that they would not be responsible for providing those services next year and they should contact their districts. It's very difficult for these students and families and districts to respond so quickly, so the language that we have here solves the problem by kind of having a status quo for a year while we figure it out. We hope to come back in February with some recommendations about how to fund the education of these students. And we have spoken with the co-chairs of Ways and Means, and there will be some other mechanism, probably a special purpose appropriation to help Portland with the additional costs of these students that are concentrated in their district. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. And I thank you for scheduling the public hearing and work session. I think this is an important bill that will extend some basic fairness to all kids, making sure that all kids have access to the same public school choices as all other kids.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kelser, were you advised that these non-discrimination laws that I guess I assumed applied to every single admission in Oregon public schools were not effective with transfer students? So I guess what I'm asking, Madam Chair, is whether or not we really need to restate these non-discrimination laws clauses because they don't currently apply, or we need to reaffirm them because they were just being ignored by school districts?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, all of the evidence would suggest that it is either misunderstood or ignored by school districts, because routinely these transfers are denied to students on IEPs, to students who speak English as a second language, and many districts have transfer policies in which they only accept inter-district transfers from certain portions of certain school districts, certain neighborhoods. That's a problem, and whatever the root cause of that is, we need to fix it. There will be no ambiguity in the law, and it will be difficult for districts to circumvent the law because they can't collect the information if we pass this bill that they are legally not allowed to consider.
So, Madam Chair, if they're just, I'm still confused. These non-discrimination clauses, I believe, apply to every student in Oregon. If they're just being ignored by districts, will passing a law change that behavior?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I believe so. It's very difficult for a family to be able to demonstrate that the reason that a transfer wasn't given was on the basis of that child's personal characteristics. In this case, it makes it very clear. One, you can't collect information about those personal characteristics. You don't know anything about the child before you've admitted them, except for their grade level and age. And you've already noted how many spaces you have in that grade level and at that school. And secondly, it requires an equitable lottery. So if the district says, I have 50 openings in the ninth grade, and you have 45 kids apply, that district must accept all 45 kids. If 52 kids apply, they now have to do an equitable lottery. So this does change the process to ensure that level of fairness.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions for Representative Gelser?
Sure.
Okay, looks like you answered them all. Thank you very much for your testimony and for all your work on this bill. And we do have two other people signed up, and they are Mike Becker and David Williams. Want to come forward and give us some brief testimony? That would be great. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee, and please go ahead.
Okay. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker, Government Affairs Director with Providence Health and Services, here today on behalf of the Child Center, and to talk in support of the A11 amendments. Just briefly, the Providence Child Center is the only pediatric skilled nursing facility in the Pacific Northwest. We provide 24-hour long-term respite and end-of-life care for medically fragile children. These are children with profound disabilities and complex medical medical needs. These children range in age from infancy to age 21. They're cared for by an interdisciplinary team. That team addresses their, they assess them, they treat them, those complex medical conditions, they monitor their symptoms, administer medications, provide leading-edge therapies. Currently, 57, 58 kids in the home. The average age of the children is age 15, and as Representative Gelser noted, the average length of stay, 10 to 12 years. Many of these children, 43 of them, attend Portland Public Schools, and the rest receive individualized education in the facility. All of these children have individual education plans. The center is truly home for these children. As you can imagine, it created quite a stir with the kids' parents when we received the interpretation as to where these children would be schooled, and we are very appreciative of Representative Gelser, the Portland Public Schools, and the state education folks for coming together and finding this interim solution. We look forward to working with all of those parties in the interim to solve this in the long term, and again, here we offer our support for the A11 amendments. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. David Williams with Portland Public Schools, just as well to express our support for the dash A11s and the portion dealing with the students at Providence. We're as well very happy that the representative came to us and helped to find a viable solution to provide education for these kids for the coming school year, and hopeful that we can all get together in the interim and find a long-term solution so that these kids get the services that they're entitled to and that the appropriate entities pay for that service as well. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for these folks? Okay, thank you again. That completes our sign-up sheet, and members, we are in a work session, and Senator Ferrioli, we have a dash A11.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash A11 amendment dated 6/24/13.
Senator Ferrioli has moved the dash A11 amendment to House Bill 2747. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, amendment is adopted. Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move the House Bill 2747A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli has moved House Bill 2747A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on his motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Bill moves to the floor. And I think, Senator Beyer, as a member of the Education Committee, if you would be willing to carry this, it's possible that Senator Roblin might prefer to carry it, but we haven't had a chance to discuss it with him. So how about if we assign it to you for now? Okay, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2747. And just so we can not lose track of what we're doing here, we're still in a work session on House Bill 2206, and by the magic of LFO, the fiscal came in while we were talking, so we now have everything ready on 2206, which I think some members were out of the room on that, but it is a very good bill dealing with the provision of services for counties, and we do have a dash A5 amendment. If members need a little time to read that, we can go to something else. We can keep moving. Senator Ferrioli, did you want us to move to another bill?
Madam Chair, I'm satisfied with the addition of the fiscal.
Is there any opposition to this bill?
There is no opposition to this bill that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2206A. Those amendments are dated 6/13/13.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli has moved the dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2206A. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Amendment is adopted. Senator Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2206A is amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Farrielly has moved House Bill 2206A as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion?
Madam Chair, I noticed in the SMS, in the fiscal impact statement, that the total election cost for Sherman County is $2,821, and that the total election cost in Multnomah County is $425,417. Madam Chair, I recommend that we discontinue having elections in Multnomah County and conduct all of them in Sherman County because of the cost savings.
I'm sure that would go over well with the county clerk in Sherman County. Thanks for the comment. Any further discussion? Okay. Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. House Bill 2206A moves to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. And I think we should assign this to someone who has some of these counties in their district, which I'm thinking of Senator Birdsugar.
Senator Birdsugar has more than enough of the counties. Yeah.
So how about if we assign this to Senator Birdsugar, assuming he's willing to carry it on the floor, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2206. And let's see if we can
Session.
Okay. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2672B. And members, this is the bill dealing with domestic workers that we heard at our last hearing. We did not have all the paperwork that day. Lori, do you want to just remind us where we are on this?
Happy to, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2672B had the Dash B9 amendment. This dealt with, if you remember, the domestic worker issues and some rights and responsibilities for employers of domestic workers and the domestic workers themselves. You were waiting for the fiscal statement on the Dash B9, and that is attached hard copy to the SMS as well as the no revenue impact statement.
Okay, thank you, Lori. And Senator Farrielly?
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the Dash B9 amendments to House Bill 2672B. Those amendments are dated 5/28/13.
Senator Farrielly has moved the Dash B9 amendment to House Bill 2672. Is there discussion on the amendment? Is there objection to the amendment? Amendment is adopted. Senator Farrielly.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2672B as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Farrielly moves House Bill 2672B as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you. I'm going to support the motion. I'm going to support the bill. I will say that I am a little bit nervous about how this will work on the ground and actual working it out. Nervous about that, but I appreciate how the amendment has been crafted to narrow it a bit. So I'm going to support it. But it's an issue that I think this legislature needs to watch carefully as it's implemented over the next couple of years.
Thank you for the comments. Further discussion. Okay. Is there objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries, and House Bill 2672B moves to the floor, and the chair will volunteer to carry this on the floor. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2672. And okay, I'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3389A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3389A prohibits a beneficiary from requiring a nonprofit purchaser at a short sale to sign an arm's-length affidavit promising not to sell or rent back to original owner of home. It creates exceptions to allow the beneficiary to continue requiring those affidavits if adequate notice of nonprofit's intention is not received, if homeowner does not cooperate with the appraisal process, or if lender's contractual or other legal obligation requires the lender to have affidavits. Changes the definition of residential trustee to clarifies the lender's certificate of compliance must be filed prior to nonjudicial foreclosure and must be unexpired at time of recording of notice of default. clarifies also that certificate of compliance does not need to be unexpired for entire length of the proceeding, just when the proceeding begins. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. Moved off the House floor with 58 ayes and 2 excused.
Okay, thank you, Lori. And looks like we have 2 people signed up to testify on this, and they are Margaret Van Vliet and Paul Cosgrove. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Bankers, the Independent Community Banks of Oregon, and Oregon Financial Services, and I'm appearing in support of House Bill 3389. There were a number of other parties, because you have a busy schedule, who are not appearing to testify in support, but they did on the other side, and I just want to briefly mention that the United Trustees Association and others involved in the housing arena have been supportive of this bill. Your staff has given a very good comprehensive description of the 3 pieces of the bill. All of them were negotiated and are consensus items. I know of no opposition to any of those items and urge your support. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Please
Madam
go ahead.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. This bill will fix a technical problem that will enable a particular foreclosure mitigation program that my agency administers to reach more distressed homeowners. This program is one aspect of what's known as the hardest hit program, which is a program that came to Oregon a few years ago from the U.S. Department of Treasury. We've been piloting this program as a way to help homeowners in Deschutes and Jackson County who are underwater, and it's been very successful. This technical fix will allow us to serve more homeowners in those counties and 3 additional counties to which we've expanded the pilot. Those 3 additional counties are Crook, Jefferson, and Josephine. It just wanted to clarify, it does not require that banks accept a short sale, but it does say that they can't deny it if the homeowner is through the refinance staying in the home, which is typically an issue with a short sale arrangement. So we're excited about the program and the successes. I believe you've got a report that describes the program in some detail. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Okay, I don't see any questions for you, so thank you for your testimony. And I know just from the emails that I've seen in testimony on the House side that a number of people, including Eric Sten and others, have worked very hard on this bill to bring it to us. And so I'm glad to see that not all of them have signed up to testify, because we do not have very much time here, but we really do appreciate the hard work that went into providing affordable housing and a way to make this market work better. Okay, so there's no one else signed up to testify. Senator Farioli, did you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3389A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 3389A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? No objection to the motion. The motion carries. Bill moves to the floor. Senator Beyer,
be happy to carry it, Madam Chair.
Okay. And we'll assign it to Senator Beyer to carry on the floor, and I'll close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3389A. And okay, let's open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3404. Lori, could you tell us about this one?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3404 allows a county to reduce its expenditures compared with expenditures certified by the Department of Revenue without altering the percentage to be paid to that county from the County Assessment Function Funding Assistant, or CAFA, account if the county received Secure Rural Schools Act dollars in amount equal to at least 10% of its property tax revenues. 2, reduction is less than 15% of certified expenditures, and reduction in expenditures does not impact assessing or valuing property at full value. The provisions expire January 2nd, 2016. It declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. No revenue or fiscal impact. and it moved off the House floor with 57 ayes and 3 excused.
Okay, thank you, Lori. And we have one person signed up to testify on this bill, and that's Alex Cutler. Would you like to come forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager, and here to express our support, Lane County's support for this measure. We testified as well in the House in support. This bill was of particular interest, a bill very similar to it, which only lasted for 1 year, which came out of the short session. And the reason it's important, Madam Chair and members of the committee, is that this bill provides a backstop for counties that may see ever decreasing amounts of dollars coming to them that used to be furnished by the timber resources of the state, which are now furnished by what's called the Secure Rural Schools Act. Secure Rural Schools Act is essentially eliminated as it exists today. There is a proposal in the Senate to reinstate that funding for 1 year. The history of the act is that it has been on a trajectory downwards, and indeed the proposal in the Senate right now is for 5%. 5% less than it was in previous years. At issue with this measure is that CAFA is a very important function for counties. It's the assessment function grant, and when it was initially instituted back in 99, the grant was designed to provide about 30 to 35% of a county's assessment function. That number has been declining over time, and the grant today provides for about 18 or 19% of the county's assessment function. The interesting thing about the grant is it has to be, county has to apply for it by May 1st of every year, and then DOR, the Department of Revenue, certifies whether your proposal meets its standards. The issue there is that essentially assessment and taxation is then taken out of the discussion for budget purposes, as the county hasn't even really started its budget negotiations or its budget committee until after May 1st and having to certify its budget by June 30th. Lane County had a particular problem in the fiscal year 12-13 because of the reductions in the elimination of the Secure Rural Schools grant program. We actually, our administrator directed departments to cut county budgets across the board by 25%. Had the assessment and taxation department gone through with that level of budget cut, Department of Revenue would not have certified the CAFA grant. What we were able to do during the short session was come to an agreement with the Department of Revenue that would allow for a 15% reduction while still maintaining the CAFA grant for those counties. What this measure does is it continues that guarantee for another biennium. I think it's worth stating that the $9 recording fee that supports CAFA, in fact, from Lane County, we're a donor county, so we're producing more money for the CAFA program than we actually get back. The legislature swept dollars that it used to appropriate for the CAFA program, and so that is also an implication for why CAFA has reduced. At any rate, we're in support of this measure and ask you to pass it to the floor.
Okay, thanks for your testimony. Any questions for this witness? Okay, it looks like you've answered them all. Thank you very much for your testimony. And members, completes our sign up sheet, and we are in a work session.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrioli.
I move House Bill 3404 to the floor of the Duke House recommended.
Senator Farrioli has moved House Bill 3404 to the floor with a Duke House recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Bill moves to the floor, and it looks like Senator Beyer, you are the only member of our committee who is a sponsor of this bill, so
be happy to carry it back.
Okay. We can do some juggling after the hearing, but this one looks like a good one for you. So Senator Beyer will carry this on the floor, and I will close the work session on House Bill 3404. And
That means I don't have to carry that one.
Let's do that. And I'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 28218. And Lori, could you tell us about this bill?
Happy to, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2821A provides that an insurer may only be reimbursed by insured for amounts paid in excess of total damages suffered by insured under personal injury protection policy. Requires uninsured motorist insurance coverage, underinsurance coverage, and personal injury protection benefits. Provide recovery to insured up to limits of policy, less any amount recovered from other policies. It also, the committee administrator in the committee that had this measure underlined would also like to add that it allows the stacking of underinsured or uninsured policies and extends personal injury protection benefit coverage from 1 year after date of injury to 2 years after date of injury. There's no revenue impact. There's a minimal fiscal impact. No statement issue attached to your staff measure summary hard copy. And it moved off the House floor with 33 ayes, 26 nays, and one excused.
Okay, thank you, Lori. And we have a few people signed up to testify on this, so we'll call Neil Jackson and Rob Dalton, if you'd like to come forward. Thanks for waiting so patiently. It's that time of session, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum. My name's Rob Dalton. I'm an attorney. I practice in Clackamas, Oregon, and I represent the victims of car accidents. I'm here today to appear on behalf of House Bill 2821. This is a bill, the part I'm going to address, that changes the way UIM stacking, underinsured motorist stacking, works in the state of Oregon. This is a mandatory coverage. If you buy an auto insurance policy in the state of Oregon, you're paying a separate premium for this coverage. We've included a chart in your materials that demonstrates what happens in a typical situation. Under current law, if a person has a catastrophic injury, which includes medical bills of $75,000, but that person only has a minimum limits policy themselves, and the at-fault driver only has a minimum limits policy, the current law acts as a minus sign. The consumer is not allowed to access the UIM portion of the policy, even though they paid a premium for it. All that HB 2821 does is changes that into a plus sign. Instead of getting $25,000, the consumer would have $50,000 to apply towards their medical bills, in this example of $75,000. We believe it's fundamentally fair, and we ask you to support it. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here also to speak on behalf of House Bill 2821A. I want to tell you very quickly a story about a young lady named Dee Dee McElhaney. She is a kindergarten teacher at Park Rose High School. She is a widowed mother of two children. In 2011, she was bringing her children back from a swimming meet over in Madras, and she was coming on Highway 26 right up at the Butte before you drop down into the Deschutes, and another driver coming in the opposite direction hit her head on. She suffered really, really bad injuries. Fortunately, her children were not hurt that badly. She had a fractured hip, fractured femur, fractured tibia. She still has the hardware in today. She now is able to walk with a limp, but she can't walk up two-legged upstairs. She spent 23 days in the hospital, 4 months in a wheelchair. Then she went to a walker, 9 months on crutches, 4 months with a cane, and as I said, she now walks with a limp. During her recovery, she incurred $285,000 in medical bills, surgeries, of course. She had to move back in with her parents, with her children, because she simply couldn't afford to live on her own on a teacher's salary. The other driver had a $100,000 policy. It's a lot bigger than what Mr. Dalton's talking about. The other driver had $100,000. She had $100,000 on her underinsured policy. She thought, well, I don't have $285,000, but if I get the coverage from the other driver and my own, I've got $200,000, and that goes a long way towards paying my bills. So she went to talk to a lawyer to make sure she understood what she was doing, and was told by her lawyer that under current law, no, she has no access to her own UIM coverage, even though she's got $285,000 in bills. All she has is $100,000 of the liability coverage from the driver who was at fault. This was devastating to her, as you can imagine. What this bill does is it changes that, and it allows her to access her own UIM coverage, which she paid for. She paid premiums for it. So she could have used $100,000 from the other driver's policy, her own $100,000, and it would have gone a lot farther towards paying off her medical bills. A couple of points I want to make. She would testify today, but she was unable to get away. But a couple of points I want to make in reference to what I believe the opponents will say. I want to remind this committee that in 2009, the legislature raised two coverages of auto policies. They raised property damage liability coverage and mandatory wage loss coverage. At that time, the insurance industry came forward and testified that it would have a skyrocketing effect on premiums that we all pay for insurance policies. The legislature adopted it. The governor signed it. It never happened. The skyrocketing premiums did not happen. Another point, in 2009, insurance representatives regarding another bill testified that 90% of their accident claim payouts were $10,000 or less. Those 90% will not be affected by this bill. This bill only affects people like Mrs. McElhaney, people who suffer catastrophic injuries. The other, we think it's probably around 3 or 4% of all accident cases that would be helped out by this bill. But it's important because those are the catastrophic injury cases. Only grievous injuries are the ones that this bill affects. And finally, on the issue of premiums, Washington has had stacking like is proposed in this bill for years and years, for decades now. We were able to obtain a listing of the rates of premiums for all 50 states. Washington, even though they have stacking, they stand 43 on the list. Oregon stands 31st. If you take the average annual premium payment, it's about $150 a year difference between Washington and Oregon, and they do have stacking. So our position is you're going to be told that rates are going to go through the roof, and you shouldn't buy it. It affects such a small number of cases. This bill does, and you really need to do this to protect those Oregonians that really get hurt badly. Thank you. Questions?
Okay, thank you for your testimony. And I think I missed the last part of what you said about the rates being modestly higher in Washington. I would assume...
I'm sorry, they're higher in Oregon.
In Oregon, okay.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. Thank you.
Okay, and it's your testimony that the provisions of the changes in House Bill 2821 mirror the law in the state of Washington.
It would make it the same. Oregon would have the same law as Washington.
Okay. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, we have two more people signed up to testify, and they are John Powell and Sean Miller, if you'd both like to come forward. Thanks for waiting so patiently, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is John C. Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies in opposition to House Bill 2821. If it's okay with the Chair, I'd like to just explain the three things the bill does, the three laws it seeks to change, and then address some points made by the previous witnesses. So the bill deals with two areas of auto insurance law. The first is personal injury protection, and the other is uninsured motorist coverage. In Oregon, these are both mandatory coverages, so everybody that buys insurance has to buy at least minimum limits of underinsured motorist coverage, as well as personal injury protection. The first thing the law does is, or this bill proposes to change, is what's called subrogation in personal injury protection. This is where an insurer or personal injury protection is a no-fault insurance product, which means your insurance company pays it regardless of whether you were at fault or there was another person that was at fault. This was put into law when states were looking at adopting wholesale no-fault insurance. And it was done so to ensure that medical providers, in the case of an auto accident, would be paid quickly and that the injured person would not have to worry about those first medical bills. After that point, health insurance takes over, whether you have private health insurance or Medicaid or Medicare. But PIP pays first. It pays until it hits its limit, and then health insurance takes over. The other aspect of it, and this is where it does get a little complicated, is what's called subrogation within PIP. So insurance companies, there's an at-fault insurer and a not-at-fault insurer. When in the at-fault insurer, or the not-at-fault insurer pays a PIP claim, after the injured person covers or collects their entire economic damages, then that insurer can, if there's any money left over, can collect those PIP payments from the at-fault insurer. The change this law seeks to make is add non-economic damages to the subrogation order. So an insurer would not be able to subrogate with the at-fault insurer until the injured person's economic and non-economic or pain and suffering has been paid in full. This means simply that insurers will get less reimbursement from the at-fault party, and that the PIP, the portion of your PIP claims will have to PIP premiums will have to rise to cover that. Number two, the law lengthens the PIP period from 1 year to 2 years. Again, we're opposed to this because PIP was never intended to replace health insurance. It was just intended to pay bills, the first payment in medical policies. When it's spread over 2 years, there's going to be more claims, and PIP prices will have to increase a little bit to cover that. And we're not saying it's a lot. State Farm actuaries estimate that that portion of the law will cost about $5 per insured vehicle in Oregon. The subrogation piece I mentioned, the actuaries estimate that will cost about $10 per car per year. The final portion was of the law, which seeks to change Oregon's difference in limits uninsured motorist coverage to a form of excess coverage, is the most expensive portion of the bill. In this instance, as the previous witness described, Oregon law in underinsured motorist coverage is difference in limits. So, for instance, if an individual buys a policy that covers $100,000 and gets into an accident with an and is harmed by an individual that has a policy that is $200,000, the injured person, even though his policy, his liability or uninsured motorist policy only covered $200,000, could collect up to the max between the parties. So when the injured person has uninsured motorist coverage of $200,000, gets into an accident with a person that has liability coverage for $100,000, that injured person can recover $200,000. Now, in the example that the previous witness indicated, which was correct, in the instance where both parties have liability limits that are the same, the injured person can only cover up to that max. He can't stack both policies on top of each other. And this law seeks to change Oregon law to mandate that those policies stack. And we estimate that that would be where the most significant cost would hit, at about $40 per insured vehicle per year, and it would hit the less affluent to a much greater degree than the more affluent. And if you'll turn to the handout I just handed out with State Farm letterhead, on page 3 of that handout, Georgia law requires insurers to offer both a difference in limits option, like Oregon has, or the stacking option, like is being proposed in this bill. And you can see the premium price differences, how they affect, if you look on the left-hand column, the 2550, that would be like a minimum limits policy. It has a great, much more effect on price on that premium than it does the policy of, you know, 500,000 to a million that more affluent individuals will purchase, because there's so more few, there's fewer accidents that would hit that amount of money. And finally, the previous witness said that this would make the law just like Washington. In Washington, PIP is an optional coverage. So an individual can choose to buy it or not choose to buy it. In Oregon, it's mandatory. Everybody must buy it. The previous witness also testified that somehow under current law, people are paying a premium for something, and then when they're injured, they're not getting paid what they should be paid. And that is just not true. People are paying a premium for a difference in limits policy. They are not paying a premium for a stacking policy. If this bill passes, they will have to pay a premium for a stacking policy, which costs more than a premium for a difference in limits policy. And in the example of the teacher from Park Rose that was injured, and I'm sure she was terribly injured, I mean, it sounds horrible. I mean, 200 and some thousand in medical bills. The issue is not whether PIP would be responsible for those medical bills. What was left out of that conversation was after her PIP benefits expired, her health insurance would pay for those medical claims. And that's the way it was designed to be. The primary difference, and I'm a lawyer, I practice law, and I understand the economics of law very well, is that in that example, if health insurance pays the premium, the lawyer representing the injured individual does not get a cut of that money. If PIP pays for that injury, the lawyer representing the plaintiff takes a portion of that dollar amount. So with that, I will end my testimony and answer any questions.
Could you just, because you really lost me in your last three sentences or so, just make that point again.
Okay, so if I'm an attorney and I'm representing somebody who was injured in an auto accident, generally I will enter into a contractual agreement with that person and say, you don't pay me anything unless you recover, unless I basically go to your insurance company and win and you recover money. And then if that happens, my fees will be paid out of that money, a certain percentage, 20, 30, 40%. So a PIP, when an injured individual represented by an attorney and the individual recovers PIP, the attorney can take a portion of that as their fee. When a health insurance company pays for the medical bills of an injured person, an attorney does not get a portion of that benefit.
I mean, believe me, I'm not a lawyer, but I don't think it's a standard feature of a retainer agreement that a lawyer gets their standard contingency on the PIP payments. I mean, I see people shaking their heads to what you were saying. So, I mean, we can certainly get more testimony on that point, but you sound like you're saying that, and this bill obviously applies whether somebody is represented by a lawyer or not. I mean, so, but
right.
I just wonder if that's really true, because it's not what I have seen to be true.
Yeah, generally a lawyer will enter into an agreement, and some lawyers do it differently than others, but a lot of lawyers will take a percentage of anything recovered by the plaintiff as part of that agreement.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony, and why don't we let you go ahead, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association, and I did pass out a
the document for you for the record today. And just to quickly talk about, because Mr. Powell talked about the differences in the bill, on the left side of the document I've provided talks about the PIP changes, personal injury protection changes in the bill. And if you recall, in 2009, the insurance division actually looked at the same bill, if you, just the left-hand side of the bill, again, not including the underinsured UIM section of the bill, and did a survey to look at the cost. When it did pass the House and come over to the Senate, they were asked by the legislature to do an analysis, and in that analysis, the result was about a 21.9% increase in the cost of the PIP coverage in Oregon. And, you know, again, Madam Chair, there's been a lot of discussions, and the previous panel did also say, comparing Washington to Oregon, and you just cannot do that in this committee. It's apples and oranges. You can't compare coverage differences when one is a you know, a mandatory coverage such as Oregon and one is an optional coverage such as Washington. And so to talk about the benefits and price, you just can't do that in the committee. But again, the Oregon Insurance Division did look at this and concluded that that would have an increase. Our estimates based on that 21.9 increase was about a $55 million increase to Oregon drivers. Then when you look at the right-hand side of the sheet and look at what was added in addition to that proposal 2009 dealing with underinsured motorist coverage, you add about another $100 million increase when you stack those benefits. Again, Mr. Powell did a good job of describing what the stacking does and paying that premium. Again, these weren't designed to replace health insurance. I think, again, the example that was given a kindergarten teacher who probably has health insurance, you take care of those immediate costs, and then those costs after that are dealt with by the health insurance carrier. And that's how it normally is today. If you increase those coverage amounts on PIP and underinsured, it's just, you know, it just changes how this whole how it works, and again, it's priced accordingly. Combined, about $155 million in higher insurance costs with the passage of this bill, and we would urge that you oppose House Bill 2821, Madam Chair, and happy to answer any questions.
Okay, questions for these folks. Senator Starr, go ahead.
Do you have, for either one of you, do you have any idea how many vehicle crashes there are in Oregon in a year?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, no, but I can get that estimate and get that information to you in the committee.
Well, Madam Chair, follow up.
Sure.
So, and I appreciate if you would. I mean, that would be interesting. But basically, insurance works because the vast majority of Oregon drivers aren't going to be in a crash this year. And the rest of the drivers potentially subsidize or take care of, through the insurance process, those injured drivers. As I see this bill, it looks like a cost increase on the working class to the tune of up to $155 million. You want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, Senator, that's correct. I mean, we view this as a dramatic increase for Oregon drivers. And when you look at the minimum limits liability, because this would affect those the most, as John said, with minimum limits. So that's people that don't add coverages and don't get additional coverages. And so minimum limits, obviously, you're less affluent. So I think the effects of the bill would affect the less affluent in the state of Oregon and increase those percentages in their premium. So, absolutely yes. And so the question is, Madam Chair, Senator Starr, on some of the examples that we've heard, and the specific example that was raised, the question is the tragic accident, again, we're not diminishing very tragic accidents here, of medical costs of $285,000, it seems to portray that it's coming out of their pocket. And again, the system was designed on PIP coverage as immediate, recovery of those costs, and then it transfers, you have your liability, but then you reach those limits and your health insurance coverage kicks in. And that's what we believe happened in this case. It's not like they're not having those costs covered. And again, you change that you're going to increase the cost to all the drivers. We do see a benefit to attorneys in Oregon being able to, when you increase those coverages, get a piece of those coverages. And so the question is, who's benefiting? Is it the consumer, or do some lawyers, are they going to get more of a benefit out of the increased coverages? And we would view that way.
Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sean, I can see your point, but I guess that assumes that everybody has medical insurance. So it would strike me that the people most likely to benefit from this are probably people of limited means who probably are buying the minimum PIP available and also have no health insurance.
I'm sure, Senator Byers, that is a good point. We do see the increase of the bill affecting those with minimum limits, so they would pay more. A lot of those folks, especially in auto insurance, that are on the bubble, then choose not to buy insurance, then become uninsured, and that also is a concern when you're raising. But to your point of those who may not have health insurance, you know, obviously the state, the country is moving into a direction where, theoretically, next year they're all going to be covered under health insurance, and so, you know, the argument of raising this now, we question that given folks will be under. But your point is well said of those who may not have health insurance. I understand that.
Yes, it does get at the issue though. You've got a product that we're mandating Oregonians buy, and yet it appears in most cases they get no benefit out of. Unless they get in the wreck and then they're injured themselves, and it's their fault.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, no benefit, are you meaning underinsured or on the PIP coverage? Again, there's two different parts of this bill. I guess, do you mean the underinsured?
The PIP.
Oh.
Go ahead if you want to.
I would just add that trying to understand your question. So you're saying that individuals that buy PIP get in an accident and they get no benefit, or you're saying people that pay for PIP coverage that don't ever get into an accident are just paying for something they never use?
Former.
So that people that get into an accident that have PIP definitely do get a benefit. That if they get into an accident and they're injured, their PIP coverage is their primary medical coverage until it runs out. It kicks in, it pays before your health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid. So anybody that gets into an accident, regardless of fault, because PIP is no fault. Your insurance company is going to pay those claims up to the limits of your policy, and then your health insurance.
Conceivably, the person who ran into you is going to pay those claims as well, eventually. I have State Farm. I get in an act. Somebody runs into me. State Farm will pay my claims initially, but they're going to go after the other insurance to cover those costs, to recover that cost, even though I've been paying the benefit or the policy on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, the bill actually would eliminate that subrogation by when you eliminate the non-economic damages, or including non-economic damages. Right now, it's economic damage. So it's your medical bills, your funeral costs, lost wages, and all those elements in the PIP statute. When you put non-economic, so you add pain and suffering to it, and you extend it 2 years, it essentially eliminates our ability to go subrogate and go after that at-fault insurer like we do now. Because of that is why we believe the increase in the bill.
I'm saying it eliminates that, or it just puts it in a secondary position.
It puts it further down.
Puts it down, so we don't.
So you'll the non-at-fault PIP insurer will collect less than the at-fault PIP insurer from the at-fault PIP insurer, which will result in that insurer needing to get a little bit more rate to cover those claims than they do now, since currently they collect a little bit more than they would if this bill became law.
Okay, you can think about that for a minute, because I'd like to clarify too. So my understanding is that PIP doesn't just cover people who are injured in a car accident. It also covers people who are injured as pedestrians. who happen to have car insurance, obviously you're not required to have car insurance to walk on the street, but so some of the scenarios of people who could be seriously injured under provisions currently or of this bill would be people just were walking along and were unlucky enough to be hit by an at-fault driver. So I guess just to play this out a little further, it seems like the fundamental inequity that this bill is trying to correct is that people are required in this state to cover, to pay for insurance, and when they're hurt through no fault of their own, that insurance is the first insurance that comes into play to pay medical bills, and I think also to cover certain kinds of lost wages if your time off is more than a week. And then, and I think it comes as a surprise to a lot of people that after those initial payments have been made, when it's clearly, in some cases, another driver that caused the injury, that their insurance is not paying in addition to the full benefits of the policy that the person was required to pay. So in other words, you know, just this order of people being paid back is the insurance company itself, for the injured party's insurance, gets paid back first, then the medical providers get paid, and then after that is when the injured party is in line to be paid. And to me, although everything about insurance is pretty complicated, and obviously when lots of lawyers and insurance companies were involved, it gets more so, it seems just not very fair that somebody who was injured seriously and perhaps permanently disabled isn't the first person who gets their medical bills and other damages paid. So could you just explain to me what I'm missing here?
Yeah, Chair Rosenbaum, the injured person is the first person that gets all of their economic damages paid. So this includes medical bills, wage loss, even funeral expenses. It does not include non-economic damages, which includes pain and suffering and those types of damages. It was designed that way to keep PIP affordable. So that all economic damages must be paid in full before the insurance companies can subrogate with each other. This bill would change that and then put that subrogation process behind both economic and non-economic damages. Does that make sense?
Well, maybe you could kind of phrase it a little differently. So
okay, so individual A gets in an accident with individual B. It's individual B's fault. Individual A is injured. Individual A's insurance company will start paying on his PIP immediately for medical bills, wage loss, and those types of issues up to the limit of his PIP coverage for all of his economic damages. After that, if all of that injured person's economic damages have been paid in full, the insurers can subrogate where the not-at-fault insurer goes after the at-fault insurer to recover anything, if there's anything there left over. This bill seeks to change that and move that subrogation process down further on the list, if you will, below non-economic damages. So right now, the subrogation process can occur after economic damages have been recovered in full. This bill will change it to where it cannot occur until economic and non-economic damages have been recovered in full.
Yeah, and I think I'm following you, but what I'm not, what it doesn't seem like you're responding to is, if I'm required to have PIP coverage, and I'm hurt, and seriously hurt, and even just my medical expenses are exceeding my PIP and the other driver's liability coverage, it seems like the insurance that I've been paying for the last 20 years should be paying these bills and the limits of the other person's policy should be paying to the full limits of the, of that policy, and the two shouldn't be that you basically pay back my insurance company out of their liability insurance first. And that seems to me to be what this bill is meant to fix.
So there's two portions, and I think we're getting confused with the portion that deals with PIP, which is separate from the portion that deals with uninsured motorist coverage. So the uninsured motorist coverage was what the prior witnesses were talking about versus the stacking versus the difference in limits. So we were just, or my example dealt only with PIP.
So,
yeah.
Madam Chair. Yeah, we can't all speak at once. So we'll interrupt the witnesses, and you'll defer to Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I'm going to try something here, and if it's unsuccessful, we should have deferred to Senator I think the problem is that we're all considering the products as one policy. The PIP and the uninsured motorists are two products completely separated. They only apply in specific circumstances. So if you get into an accident with somebody who has no insurance, your uninsured motorist policy kicks in. That's the one you've been paid for. If you have a wreck with somebody who has insurance, their insurance product to the limits of their liability is what kicks in. You don't have access to the uninsured motorist policy because there's no uninsured motorist in the accident. Is that right?
That's correct for uninsured motorist
right.
coverage. But you also
Hold on. So now the PIP policy is a no-fault policy to the limits of its liability, and it kicks in for the policyholder, regardless of fault, if there's an injury. But the PIP policy doesn't trigger the UIM policy, and the UIM policy doesn't trigger the PIP policy. They're separate products. So I think the thing is, if you've got an insurance policy that has a PIP limit of $25,000 and a UIM policy with a limit of $25,000, you think you have $50,000 in coverage. You don't. You have two separate incidences, two different products, both of have a limit of $25,000. Does that help?
No.
It made perfect sense to me, Madam Chair.
Hey, it was an attempt.
The piece, well, we're getting confused.
We got that piece understood.
Yeah. In Senator Farioli's example, there's a third piece to that, which is underinsured motorist coverage. Now, that is the example that we've been using here, where two people get into an accident, they both have insurance. One person has underinsured motorist coverage of X amount. The other person has liability coverage of X amount. Now, when those are the same, say $100,000, this person can't collect the $100,000 from the person that caused the harm and the $100,000 from his own insurance. That's stacking. That's what this bill seeks to do. Their underinsurance only covers up to $100,000 for instances when they get into an accident with somebody who only carries $50,000 in coverage. They can collect an extra $50,000 up to the $100,000 underinsured motorist because that person had less insurance but still had insurance than their underinsured motorist policy. And that is something, you know, individuals can buy more of it by higher limits or lower limits currently.
Did you want to jump into this, Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, it's very simple, very clear to me. We have an insurance situation today mandated by state law. We have insurance companies out there that are delivering bills to insurance to drivers. 90-some-odd percent of us don't get in accidents. A certain percentage of folks do. And the law today is working the way the law is intended to work. The question for this committee is, do we want to change the law to increase the coverages, forced coverages on everybody? And if we do, that's fine, but it's going to cost $150 million or so on primarily poor drivers to subsidize the increased cost. The question is, do we want to do that or not? Because at the end of the day, somebody has to pay. And, you know, there's money doesn't grow on trees. So the question before the committee is, do we want to increase the rates on primarily poor drivers to cover these increased costs to the insurance companies? That's the question. The answer is yes or no. I personally don't think that the working class individuals in my district want a $155 million tax increase forced on them. So it's very clear for me where I'm going to be on it. But that's the choice that the committee has to make.
Well, thank you, Senator Starr, for your opinion. I think my opinion is somewhat different, that when people are paying for insurance coverage and are...
Well, you have to change the law in order to accommodate that. That's my only point.
Right. And I think that's exactly what we're discussing in this bill. Right. So to say nobody would ever want to actually get the benefits of their insurance policy in the way people in other states can get them, so that when they're seriously injured in excess of the limits of what's covered, they should at least have the benefit of the coverage that they're paying for, as well as the benefit of what the other at-fault driver was also paying for, and shouldn't be stuck with staggering amounts of debt for stuff that insurance should have covered to begin with. Then I just disagree with your analysis of what's going on here, but you're certainly entitled to see it that way.
At the end of the day, somebody has to pay those bills. The money doesn't grow in the tree, and it has to come out of every one of our pockets who don't get the accidents. So, and that's, I mean, at the end of the day, the money has to come from somewhere.
Well, at the end of the day, when people aren't compensated for permanent disabilities, we also, taxpayers, have to bear the responsibility for that coverage. So for that matter, every single Oregonian is disadvantaged by the current scheme, in my view, but that's my opinion. Okay, any other questions for these witnesses?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay,
thank you
for your testimony. Is there anybody else who wants to testify on House Bill 2821? I don't see anybody, and I think we need Senator Burdick to return, so we will try to get her back. And hopefully we'll get her shortly. So I'll recess our public hearing and work session on House Bill 2821, pending Senator Burdick's return. And looks like I think we have one more bill up, so why don't we try to knock that one out. And I'll open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 805. And Lori, could you please tell us about this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 805 allows judicial review of contracting agencies' cost analysis procurement of services if violation of cost analysis process is alleged. Requires a contracting agency include profit of potential contractor in the cost analysis, prohibits the agency from including proceeds or revenues from sale of long-term assets in cost analysis, becomes operative January 1st, 2014, declares emergency, its effect upon passage. There is a dash one amendment attached to your hard copy. It's also hand engrossed, if that helps. And that dash one clarifies that the contracting agency proceeds with a procurement if it advertises or solicits the procurement or takes affirmative steps to seek a contractor for performance of procurement, but specifies request for information or quote is not proceeding with procurement. Modifies the reviewing court standard of review. It requires a de novo review of the agency's determination. It removes requirement that contracting agency cancel procurement if court rules in favor of employee. It retains the requirement the court enjoin contracting agency from proceeding if the court rules in favor of employee. It prohibits the award of costs and attorney fees to prevailing party. Requires the contracting agency issue a request for information or request for quotation prior to advertising or soliciting procurement. Requires the information obtained from bids, proposals, or other sources after advertising or soliciting procurement be included in cost analysis or determination. Requires agency reconsider that determination if necessary in light of new information. There's no revenue impact on the dash one. However, we do not have a fiscal impact statement. We're waiting for the review of that as we speak.
Okay, thank you, Lori. And now that we have that great explanation, I think I'll recess this hearing for a moment. Reopen the work session on House Bill 2821A. And we are in a work session. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2821A to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2821A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Okay. Discussion? No discussion? Okay. Mike, would you please call the roll?
Senator Meyer?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
No.
Vice Chair Perioli?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye.
And Madam Chair, I voted no. I'll be serving a notice of a possible minority report.
Thank you. Motion carries, and Senator Beyer has served notice, and I...
Actually, it was Senator Perioli, but if Senator Beyer wishes to join me in the minority report, he's welcome to do so.
Senator Perioli has served notice, so the motion carries, the bill moves to the floor, and we need a carrier, and since no one's jumping forward, the chair will volunteer to carry the bill on the floor, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2821A. And
okay, you got a carry on.
So now we're still in our hearing on Senate Bill 805. Lori just explained the bill, and we have several people signed up to testify on this, and I'll call Tricia Smith and Sarah Drescher, and it looks like Brian DeForest, if you'd like to come forward. Good afternoon. I know it's been a long hearing, but thank you for waiting through all these other issues, so we're all ears.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I'm happy to be here this afternoon testifying in favor of Senate Bill 805 and the Dash 1 amendments. The statutes today require a public contracting agency, that's the state, cities, counties, school districts, public agencies, with some exceptions, to, when they are considering contracting out work that is normally performed by their employees, to conduct a feasibility analysis, which is, can we do this ourselves, yes or no, and a cost analysis, if they can do it themselves, to determine whether or not a potential contract will provide them savings that are not savings exclusively found in lower wages and benefits for the workforce. Senate Bill 805 makes a few modest changes to the law and allows a process to challenge a cost analysis when it is done incorrectly. When the original bill was passed that required the cost analysis, it included, as I said, state agencies, and we participated in a work group after the bill was passed to allow DAS to develop administrative rules for state agencies that would consider contracting out. The work group also was tasked with looking at changes to the law that needed to be made. That work group was constituted in 2009 and produced recommendations for the 2010 special short session. Some of those proposals, or one of those proposals, is included in Senate Bill 805. Since passage of the cost analysis requirements, unfortunately, some local governments and school districts seem to have spent their time trying to circumvent the requirements rather than trying to comply with them. This practice puts scarce public dollars at risk to more expensive contracts that cannot be undone in the future. The main points of objection to the original law, and I think you'll find today in to Senate Bill 805, have been that the process is unnecessary, it's too complicated, and it's time-consuming. One of the handouts that I provided to you with a blue cover is the National State Auditors Association best practices document on things that they think should be done when an agency is considering contracting for services. You'll notice on the first page of the document, under decision to contract, the number two requirement or suggestion is that that the agency conduct a cost-benefit analysis and evaluate options, such as whether contracting is more or less expensive than using agency staff. And that's simply all a cost analysis does. We think it's entirely appropriate for an agency to understand what their costs are internally and externally to provide a service before they decide whether or not they should provide it themselves or continue to provide it themselves, excuse me, or to contract out the work to a private sector industry. When I buy something that costs a lot of money and I'm going to be obligated for a long time, I try to make sure I know what that cost is, and that's all the requirements and Senate Bill 805 require of agencies, that they know what their costs are prior to making the decision to contract. We think that these objections too time-consuming, too complicated, are the very reason that the legislature, as stewards of public funds, should strengthen the cost analysis requirements, as we have asked in Senate Bill 805. That public agencies object to the requirements and statutes, in our opinion, speaks volumes to the need of the legislature to clarify them and allow a workable process to take the faulty analysis to court. I have provided, along with my testimony in written form, in paper form today, the summary of a recent study that the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon conducted on the contract that had been let since the law passed. And that study shows clearly the way school districts have skirted the intention and requirements of the cost analysis statute to contract out jobs since passage of the law requiring them. The study illuminates the reasons that Senate Bill 805 is before you. Senate Bill 805 will improve the cost analysis requirements by clarifying that government agencies can obtain information needed to conduct a cost analysis through a request for information. Now I'm talking about 805 plus the amendment. The bill also requires that the sale of long-term assets not be considered in the cost analysis because that is a one-time sale, a one-time benefit, and has nothing to do with the ongoing cost of providing the service. And that profit of the potential contractor be considered. The rules I mentioned earlier that DAS adopted and has been working under, as state agencies have been working under since 2009, require that that profit be considered. Agencies, as far as we know, have not had any problem doing that. Because local governments and school districts are not obligated to follow DAS rules, without 805, they do not have to require, or they do not have to consider profit. To not consider profit is to not consider a cost. And when you're comparing the cost of doing it yourself and doing it with someone else, it's one of the costs, and so it should be considered. And then finally, the bill provides a quicker, less expensive writ of review process when a cost analysis is challenged and clarifies that impacted employees and their union may bring such a challenge to the courts. Currently, there are many school district contracts for services that are troubling because of the lack of information regarding whether only appropriate costs are being paid for by districts and the state. When subsequent contracts are found to be more expensive, districts have little power to change the terms since they no longer have the ability to provide the service in-house. Because there's no turning back once a service has been contracted out, it's important that the rules for doing so provide a process that allows the district and the public to understand the true costs of the contract. Senate Bill 805 will help assure that outcome.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. And I will ask you, we certainly want to hear what you have to say, but if you could summarize as much as possible, because you have several other people signed up and it's getting late in the day.
I will try. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Drescher. I represent employees and labor unions in Oregon. I'm here today to express my support for Senate Bill 805 and the amendment. Since the cost analysis and feasibility requirements were created in 2009, employees and their representatives have really struggled with how to force compliance. And the reason for that is that there is nothing in the current law that allows you to remedy an agency's violation. In the public contracting code, there is a legal remedies provision for a bidder to challenge an agency's compliance and to get that reviewed through the court system. But there's no similar process for employees to challenge the compliance with the cost analysis requirements. And so there's no way to enforce the cost analysis and feasibility requirements in this code. It's a law without any teeth. And as a result, agencies have been able to circumvent the law's requirements. So the main thing that Senate Bill 805 does is it creates a judicial review process to remedy violations in the cost analysis and feasibility requirements. And it is modeled after the judicial process that is already in the code for other violations. They say a picture is worth a thousand words. And because I've been asked to keep it brief, I have submitted to you a cost analysis that was completed by the Central Point School District after the law was passed in 2009. And I think it is worth a thousand words in support of Senate Bill 805. If you look at this, you will see that the district's estimated costs for its own costs, they're good. They're completely filled out on the left-hand side. But on the right-hand side, the district's estimated costs for the private contractor's costs are blank. They're missing information that's required by the law. There are statements saying that they simply cannot determine certain costs because they don't have information. And there are baseless assumptions that assume that the contractor's costs for paying retirement benefits are going to be exactly the same as a public school district's costs. For the reasons discussed in my written testimony, Senate Bill 805, as amended, would prevent this type of meaningless cost analysis. It would also allow employees and the representatives the opportunity and the means to remedy a violation of the cost analysis. Without an enforcement mechanism within this law, the legislature's original goal, which was to ensure fiscal responsibility, sound expenditure of taxpayer dollars to a private company, and preserve family wage jobs in Oregon, those goals cannot be achieved. You have to have an ability to hold people accountable. Our opponents will say that it's too difficult to comply with this, and I want to remind you when you hear that today, we're not changing the requirements of the cost analysis itself. That's the law already. They have to comply. It's passed in 2009. So when you hear them say this is too difficult, it's too costly, they already have to do that. What we're adding is a judicial remedy for violations. And also, when they say that they won't be able to proceed and no one will be able to contract out in Oregon ever again, as you'll see in our Senate Bill 805, there is a provision that says if you have a compelling government interest, you can proceed. This does not prevent contracting out. If you have a compelling government interest, you can proceed. And finally, they will say that the cost of litigation will be enormous and we can't afford this. And I will tell you that I've spent the last 2 years in litigation over trying to determine the proper way to remedy this with the Central Point School District. We're now at the Court of Appeals 2 years in, four attorneys, and we have spent an enormous amount of attorney's fees just to figure out what's the legal process. So this bill will save us in our attorney's fees because it tells us here's the process, and that is what is most important. I encourage you to vote yes and pass Senate Bill 805 as amended. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. And please go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian DeForest from the Department of Administrative Services, where I serve as the Deputy Chief Finance Officer. My apologies that Diane Lancaster, the State Procurement Officer, could not be here. She is unable to be here this week. The Department of Administrative Services will be neutral on the bill, and we only offer, as the previous testimony, a testifier had offered, that cooperatively DAS has developed administrative rules, and to date, there is no state agencies that have had to go down this path of disputed procurement. So from a state perspective, we are already on solid ground and are already working cooperatively with our stakeholders and major partners. I would offer just a couple of notes of concern. While I do not enjoy going down hypothetical roads, there are a couple of provisions inside of the bill that do raise some eyebrows, and that is that any employee of the affected agency or the agency that is going to do their procurement may raise this to a judicial level. One of our agencies has well over 7,000 people, and an employee from let's just say, the City of Ontario or who is stationed in Ontario may dispute a procurement that is done in another part of the state. And so we would be cautious about that. Additionally, adding another 30 days within a procurement adds time and money and effort into making those procurements. But again, Department of Administrative Services and all of the state agencies have not had to go down this road. So at the moment, we will remain neutral.
Okay, thanks for your testimony. Any questions? Yes, Senator Beyer? Was that a stretch or a
stretch? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Thank you. And I'll call Brian Smith, Lori Sattenspiel, and Scott Winkles.
Madam Chair, Lori Sattenspiel for the Oregon School Boards. Here in opposition today to Senate Bill 805 and the Dash Ones. Our locally elected school board members are involved in a lengthy process to balance our budgets. The budgets provide students with the educational needs that move them forward to attain the current Oregon goal of 40-40-20, which is to be achieved by the year 2025. Madam Chair, that's 100% of kindergartners this year that need to graduate. That makes the process very difficult to come up with putting dollars to the classroom. How do we balance our budgets? Districts and the budget committees look at ancillary services, services that provided that are provided not directly to the classroom, your food service, custodial, and transportation. Districts often look at the options to have an outside management company come in and help direct those services. Under 2867 that was passed in 2009, I was a part of that work group. We did sit with Department of Administrative Services to try to help guide our school districts work through this law. I think what was mentioned here about the national auditors, best practices. Madam Chair, best practices don't include excluding information when we're looking at a cost analysis. That includes all information, including salaries and benefits. The original law says we can't look at salary and benefits. So I wonder about best practices. Is that really best practice? This bill does add another layer to our process. I believe it says in there that throughout the procurement process that outside sources can deliver more information, causing a district to have to go back and redo the cost analysis. I'm not sure what those outside sources would be, other than it could be an individual, a local community member. Again, it delays the process and causes more challenges. Districts don't particularly care to expend dollars for legal challenges. That's money that isn't in the classroom. We heard mention of Central Point School District and their challenge to go outside for busing. They are in the court system. However, that wasn't mentioned was their decision to go out, the courts upheld, they did do the cost analysis correctly, and that's now been challenged. So see, we're already at a level of doing the process correctly based on the information that we've helped districts to provide. I also might add that in this process of Central Point that we notified the union that we were going to look at this a year ahead of time. They wouldn't come to the table and talk about how we look at our ancillary services. Notified again in the spring, still didn't want to come and talk about this. So I just wanted to put some of those on the record and be happy to answer any questions in the essence of time.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, committee members. My name is Brian Smith, the purchasing manager for Multnomah County in District 21 and a resident of Senator Burdick's District 18. In 2009, the proponents of feasibility and cost analysis legislation made well-intentioned claims about how these requirements would work in terms of preserving jobs from indiscriminate outsourcing by public agencies. The original text of this particular law came from statutes that have been passed in effect for some time in both Michigan and California.
At the time of the work sessions, proponents acknowledged that they had no idea how well it was or wasn't working in those states to accomplish these stated goals. Their intent was to just try it out and see how it works. We now have 3 years of experience with this law in Oregon, and I'd like to talk to you about my first-person experience as someone who has to implement these provisions and can talk to you about how it works. The summary is that the feasibility and cost analysis requirements result in plenty of additional bureaucracy and no demonstrable benefit to Multnomah County. I believe it's classic red tape, and the changes proposed by both SB 805 and the Dash 1 amendments simply heap additional requirements on public agencies. Here are some facts about the last 3 years. In Multnomah County, we've had 25 projects subject to these requirements. We've done only one cost analysis, and that was for fleet maintenance service, a project which was never procured because we combined these services with another governmental agency. Multnomah County procures primarily services and a lot of client services, which are exempt from the provisions of this law. Many staff are confused about how this law's applicability to their programs, and I tend to see staff err on going through the process of completing the documentation rather than risk being out of compliance. On average, it takes about 3 hours of staff time to create and review each form to document compliance. And on average, I spend 16 hours a year on the quarterly reporting of my local contract review board about these projects. My experience is that the feasibility and cost analysis requirement adds both time and cost to our procurement process, but not value. Regarding SB 805 and the Dash 1 amendments, there are several items which stand out as problematic. First, estimating the profit of the potential contractor would realize depends on so many factors outside of the control of the contracting agency. For example, a contractor's size, their debt load, their employee productivity. This is no better than guessing. The Dash 1 amendment requirement to do an RFI or RFQ does nothing to change this underlying problem. This section's impractical and should be amended out. Second, the bill prevents excluding proceeds or revenue from a sale of long-term capital or other assets in the cost analysis. This is a one-sided provision in that it precludes the contracting agency from determining the highest and best use of its assets and using that information in the decision to move forward with a procurement or not. Third, I believe the provision for judicial review, which are included in this bill, would increase the likelihood that critical projects would experience delay due to litigation. The Dash 1 amendment exacerbates this because it removes the awarding of court costs and attorney fees, and this removes any disincentive to take or threaten to take to court each and every determination that a public agency may make. And lastly, the Dash 1 amendment adds barriers to the roadblocks already created to keep agencies from conducting these procurements. It not only creates additional burden of requiring the public agency to go through the public process of gathering information for the cost estimates, but it also requires the agency to update the cost analysis or reconsider their determination if someone doesn't agree with the data gathered through the public process. This is all before anyone who doesn't agree with the cost analysis can even request judicial review, which is yet another set of hurdles. All of these provisions were features of the original legislation and didn't pass muster then. It's not been my experience that indiscriminate outsourcing of public services is a problem. We have 3 years of experience with these requirements in Oregon, and I believe the experience demonstrates that the provisions in this bill are both unnecessary and counterproductive. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, and it looks like you were reading from written testimony. Did you submit that?
No, but I would be happy to.
Okay, so we can post it.
Yes.
Okay, and Scott, if you could please summarize your testimony.
I will be brief, Madam Chair.
I know you have a lot to say, but...
For the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. I want to bring up something. I won't repeat what my colleagues have said, but I do want to point out that the current state of the law in this matter is the result of an extensive work group process that occurred in the 2009 legislative session. The League participated in that work group. We participated in good faith. We have lived with the commitments made when we agreed to, when we dropped our opposition to the bill. It has not been easy to do so, as has been outlined by previous testimony, but we were good to our word. In point of fact, there were two pieces of legislation introduced in this session that addressed this topic from the management side that the League specifically elected to stay out of and not endorse because the League and I personally felt it would be dishonorable to do so because of the commitments made in 2009. We are now taking one of the few areas where the public sector management and public sector labor were able to reach an accommodation, and we are now undoing the agreements that were made in 2009 and the work group and the negotiated process that occurred then. Additionally, some of the examples to support this legislation missed the mark entirely. On the House side, proponents of the companion bill allege that the city of Wilsonville has simply failed to comply with the feasibility with the requirements of the statute. I personally reviewed the documents and the process the city of Wilsonville used, and it's simply inaccurate to say that they ignored the statute. They participated in a very long, thoughtful process when they did what's called a design, build, operate wastewater treatment model that has worked very well for the city and for the ratepayers in their jurisdictions. If we are going to reopen this section of House Bill of ORS 279, it should be done not in a one-sided approach, but in a collaborative way, as the current status of the statute was drafted. With that, I'll be eager for your questions.
Okay. Any questions? Yes, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What would it cost an individual to allege a violation of the cost analysis process? In other words, how would it be done? Could you do it with an email? Would it require a stamp?
You could certainly do it with an email.
What does it cost an effective agency to participate in a judicial review if one was triggered by an individual who had standing?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Farioli, that would depend on whether or not the agency had in-house counsel or not, or if they had to contract for external counsel. I think, based on our legal bills, if you're using an associate in a large firm, probably $250 an hour for the legal work would be my guess.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, currently I'm going to approximate where Central Point stands right now and the legal costs that they've incurred to defend their procurement, approximately $170,000.
Madam Chair.
Follow up.
If this Senate Bill 805 is adopted, you would not be able to recover any of those attorney fee or costs. Is that correct?
My understanding, that's correct.
Are you currently, Madam Chair, if I could follow up, are you currently able to receive an award of attorney fees or costs if you prevail against the allegation?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, not that I'm aware of.
So this is just quite a good leveraging opportunity for somebody who wants to slow a process down or prevent any contracting out. Zero cost at the front end, total costs to the agency, and no recovery for the agency if they prevail. Is that correct?
Additional questions?
Sure.
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, were you done?
Well, the other question, Madam Chair, was how would you begin to determine the net profit of a contractor?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, we actually dealt with this issue as we were trying to, on our fleet maintenance services, get at that issue. And the first thing when you look at this question and say, how am I going to get the profit margin for, in this case, companies that would be interested in maintaining our fleet? Our fleet maintenance manager had a particularly difficult time because simply picking up the phone to large fleet maintenance companies and saying, hey, can you tell me what your profit margin is for those who are in the business community a fairly ridiculous question to ask. And so the provisions that are in the Dash 1 amendment that would in 805 and then the Dash 1 amendment that says basically the public agency would need to do an RFQ or an RFI to gather this information, it's just kind of ridiculous on its face in terms of expecting that you're going to get an answer when there's not even a procurement at stake, a real RFP. You're just simply out there asking the question of the business community and saying, hey, we're thinking about doing X service. Can you tell us what your profit margin would be on that? That's why that particular provision at that point in the process, until you actually put an RFP out on the street and you've asked in that RFP, tell us what your profit margin on this would be, and this is a real offer from a real vendor which has the potential to have a real contract awarded to it, you're not going to get that information.
Did that answer your question?
It does, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator Starr?
Thank you very much. From Multnomah County, how many employees are there in in Multnomah County?
I believe we're at about 4,500.
So, Madam Chair, follow-up question.
Yeah, follow-up.
So, in the event that the Multnomah County wanted to contract out anything, any one of the 4,500 employees under this new law, would it be have the ability to, as Senator Farrelly pointed out, send an email and create this process where the buyer would be required to go to a court?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
So, if you under this new law, if it were to pass, it says an employee of a contracting agency, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera,
yes,
may seek judicial review of the contracting agency cost analysis or determination if. So, any one of those 4,500 Multnomah County employees could trigger that process.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I believe, yes, any of them could, as well as others. The way in which the Dash 1 amendment is, the way I interpret it, is anyone. It identifies as additional information from any other source. So I don't think that's limited to any employee, even.
Follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Sure, follow-up.
Is it safe to say, I mean, from your testimony, that the effective result of Senate Bill 805 with the Dash 1 amendments would be to end contracting out from cities, counties, and school districts in the state of Oregon?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr, yes, I think it would, because what the bill does is it asks for information, requires us to get information that is impractical, if not impossible, to get, and then subjects the process to judicial review, which is completely unreasonable. I don't believe that's, I think that would be the result, if not the intent.
Okay. I guess my question for you is, and I guess particularly for you, Scott, we set up this process, and you were obviously part of the work group that did that. It seems like, at least on the part of the proponents of this bill, when they believe that the current process is not being complied with, there's really no effective remedy available, and by everybody's mm-hmm. testimony, it's resulting mm-hmm. in a lot of time and expense and not a resolution to it. So have you got ideas for what you think, if this isn't the right solution, what a better direction would be to go?
Chair Rosenbaum, I think if I were in the position of the proponents of the bill, what I think would have been appropriate was for them to approach us in the interim and have a very long, detailed process, and we can discuss their concerns and try to work that out and come to you together with some recommendations. I think most of what I heard today was based on some services that really aren't relevant to cities dealing with buses, and I don't have any expertise on that matter. So I would want to hear from them what issues on city governments there are having before I could say what that fix is. But I think the example we heard on Wilsonville simply didn't hold water.
Okay, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make sure that I have the right information, right impression here. As I understand the laws that exist today, it requires you to contract, to do the analysis before you issue a contract, before you contract out. It doesn't require you to do the analysis before you issue an RFP. So I don't understand why it would be hard to do the analysis. I would assume if I were doing it, I would certainly have an analysis, or I'd ask my staff to do an analysis of what you think it's costing to do it now. Then I would issue the RFP, and then reasonable staff work would be, once you have the RFP, you're comparing what it costs you to what the proponents, the vendors, are saying it's going to cost them. So I don't understand why it's hard to get that information.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, the requirement is to do a feasibility study and then cost analysis if the feasibility study warrants it, prior to being able to go out for a procurement for an RFP. And so you need to have that information beforehand, before you hit the street with an RFP, which is a tender to the business community that says, hey, we're thinking about buying this. submit your proposal. So it requires, and my position is not that it's bad to have to go through a cost analysis and to really have good solid figures about that to make a good informed decision. We just have a mismatch here between when during the process do you have that kind of information.
You're saying the current law precludes an agency from doing an RFP before
yes.
they?
Yes, if you have not done the feasibility and cost determination. Feasibility determination, cost analysis, prior to doing the RFP.
Okay, I don't see any other questions. Thank you all for your testimony. We have one other person signed up to testify, and that is Andy Boker. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but...
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Boger. I'm employed by Service Employees International Union Local 503. We're speaking in support of this bill. Many of the points that I had planned to share with you have been made by previous speakers, so I just simply like to reiterate our basic position is that what the amendments to the state contracting code in 2009 required was that agencies spend a little bit of money in order to potentially save a lot of money by doing these feasibility studies ahead of time. Unfortunately, when these amendments were passed, no enforcement mechanism was written into the law. And a law that doesn't have an enforcement mechanism has very little value. I submitted written testimony that you can look at, but I wanted to just get back to one point that came up a little bit earlier about the issue of recovering attorney fees. And on the second page of this bill, 805, line 40, it says the court may award costs and attorney fees to the prevailing party in the litigation. So I take that to mean that if the employer prevails, they can recover their attorney fees just as can the litigant. Thank you. Those are some of my testimony today.
Okay. Any questions? Could you just point us again to what
yes.
and line you were referring to in the bill?
Page 2, line 40 to 41.
You have the bill. It's only
20. And this version of it that I'm looking at is section 2. Let's see, section 2.3.
Yeah, I think
we found it. Okay.
We did find it, but I think it's been amended out in these amendments.
I was looking at the amendments and didn't see that.
Yeah, I'm chairing the dash one SMS about halfway through the effective committee amendments. Dash one prohibits the award of costs and attorney's fees for the prevailing party. So it is the dash one that removes the prevailing party attorney fees.
Okay.
And costs.
All right. Well, the copy of the amendments that I have didn't show that, but thank you.
I'm Lori, just go ahead and clarify.
And the dash one amendments on line 22, I believe, of the first page, do you see
which says
of the amendments?
Change so made to not.
To not after it's that.
Okay.
Changes it.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. I don't see any other questions, and there's no one else signed up to testify on this bill. And so we are in a work session. Senator Byer, did you have a motion?
I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated 6/20/13.
Senator Byer has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 805. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Senator Ferriero.
I object, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mike, would you please call the roll?
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
No.
Vice Chair Ferrioli?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Amendment is adopted. Senator Byer?
Let's see. I move Senate Bill 805 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 805 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I find DAS's neutrality at the present time utterly incredible. So I would urge DAS to reassess its position and do so post-haste, because we're at that time of the year with all of the agencies affected that are listed in this SMS, virtually every state agency, school district, county. I would assume that having the additional information of the dash one in the final form of the bill to review, that DAS's position may change. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion? Okay. Mike, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
No.
Vice Chair Kelly?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries.
I serve notice of possible possible reconsideration, possible minority report.
Okay, Senator Starr has served notice. I will assign Senator Roblin, who's asked to carry this on the floor, and I'll close the work session. And with nothing further to come before us today, we are adjourned. Thank you.